Matthew, chapter 5. Big surprise. We're just racing through this chapter. I think, let's see, this is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, our seventh week on these first 13 verses. We are going to look at Matthew, chapter 5, verses 13 and following this morning.
And following,
yes. I'll just read the passage and then we'll go from there. You are the salt of the earth. But if salt has lost its taste, how shall its saltiness be restored? It's no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled under people's feet. Well, as you mentioned, I brought one of my library with me, and this is a book called Salt, A World History. Everything you ever didn't want to know about salt. I read probably a good two-thirds of the book. Absolutely fascinating. If you're interested, it'll be up here afterwards. I know no one ever comes up here when I say that, but it's here if you want to look at it. There's actually no other book like it.
I read this where we got the word salary from. People used to get
that is correct. That is, the word salary comes from the Latin word for salt, because Roman soldiers were paid in salt. It was currency. The Greeks called salt Theion, or divine. They also called it caritas, or grace, because it was the source of life. Without it, you died. It's interesting. You know, we take something like salt and we look at this verse, and then of course I start my trivial pursuit into the details about salt, just out of my own curiosity. And I find more and more and more and more about it. All I have to say is that we take it for granted, don't we? Absolutely take salt for granted. You don't even think about it. If your salt shaker is a little low, you go into the pantry and pull out your Morton's canister and you pour some more in. If the canister's low, you go to Safeway and get some more. It's no big deal. You realize wars were fought over this little thing? Yeah.
Yeah, I was going to say, I don't know if you're familiar, out by Luke Air Force Base, the salt mine, they had salt up, but that's one of the major salt mines.
It's one of the largest salt mines in the western United States is under Luke Air Force Base. Did you know that?
Of course, I bought a package of oranges and a package of evaporating. The cashier charged me with a salt and a battery.
Oh, please. You need to leave. But yeah, there's 15 to 30 cubic miles of salt under Luke Air Force Base. It's owned by the Morton Salt Company. They bought it in 1985. And you think, I had no idea. No, I had no idea until I actually Googled, where does Morton get their salt from? I just started digging, and where in the world do they find this stuff? And it's just down the street. Now, the salt you eat on your table is not what's taken out from under Luke Air Force Base. That kind of salt is what you find in your soft water treatment pellets. That's a particular kind of salt. And you think, well, how do they get it out? I don't see any big dredging equipment. And
they got pretty good.
Well, what they have is they have pipes way deep underground, and they inject water into the underground salt, turns it into a brine, suck the water back out, big pools, and they just let them dry because we have so much sun, except for the last few weeks. Can you imagine the mess they had with all the rain coming in on top of their salt pools? Probably really messed up their whole process.
And you had mentioned the salt that we eat in wintertime with the ice.
Oh, yeah. In fact, apparently, from what I was able to discern, only about 80% of the salt that, I'm sorry, 20% of the salt that's mined worldwide is what we use to eat with. All the rest is used for everything else. You mentioned rock salt for the winters. Soft water is another thing. It's also in all sorts of different industrial processes. Do you know the French Revolution, one of the major causes for the revolt was the new tax on salt? It wasn't just because they were starving. They were not only starving, but they were the queen wanted more money, the king wanted more money, and so they taxed the salt. I found this, let's see, in colonial India, only the British government could produce and profit from the salt production conducted by Indians living on the coast. Gandhi chose to protest this monopoly in March of 1930, and so he and his followers marched for 23 days, and when they arrived at the coast, Gandhi violated the law by boiling a chunk of salty mud. The march became known as the Salt March to Dandi, or the Great Satyagraha, and people across India began making their own salt in protest, and the march became a milestone in the struggle for Indian independence. That's this modern era. This isn't 1830, this is 1930. Salt was still an issue because the British controlled the salt. In the Civil War, one of the economic turning points, not a battle per se, but an economic turning point was when the North spent 36 hours in a battle over Saltville, Virginia, which was the major holding area and salt mine for the Confederate Army. And when they captured it, suddenly the Confederate Army did not have salt in the quantities they needed to be able to move around to, you know, take care of their food and all that. And so President Jefferson, he offered a waiver of military service if you would go to the coasts of North and South Carolina to man their coastal salt pools to help make salt because they didn't have any way to get it. And you think, okay, so what's the big deal? I mean, just go to the grocery store. It's common, isn't it? It's everywhere. Well, yes and no. Wherever there were large repositories or deposits of it, it became protected by armies, militia, companies, corporations, because that was a major source of revenue. Going back, even in other parts of history, it's my own, and I've told you this before, but growing up and going to high school in Honolulu, one of the fun little things that I would do is watch the Japanese TV station to watch the sumo wrestling, because it would be televised from the matches in Japan. I couldn't understand a single word that was being said, but I knew the names, I knew the scores, I was able to follow my favorite players. And you think, okay, that's just silly. Well, part of the reason the attraction is this was the first time there was an American who was the grand champion. His name was Takamiyama. He was about 6'4 and weighed 540 pounds or some unreal amount. He was so much larger than his 300 pound opponents. He would toss them around the ring like they were confetti. He was even on Johnny Carson. I have to give you a little aside, but I remember watching him on Johnny Carson. And Johnny, the guy had been hit in the throat in a recent match, so his voice was really raspy. And in perfect English, but he has an American name. He grew up in California, but he had gone over to the to Japan, gone through the whole things when he was in late high school and began developing into this grand champion. And at one point, Carson Lee, you know, kind of leaned over and went, "Man, you are really fat." You know, just one of those things the audience guffaws. Takamiyama leaned over with his massive fist, grabbed Carson from behind the head, and went, "Ho, ho, 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 ho," like this. Carson leaned up and is like, "That wasn't scripted." And he like, "Let's go to a commercial break." He had just been assaulted. Yeah, I got you. He had just been assaulted on TV. And of course, after the break, they come back, and Carson wanted to do a demonstration of sumo wrestling with the world grand champion. And of course, the grand champion pulls off his robe and in his little, you know, his little girdle. And then, of course, Carson, his little tiny body, does his thing. And he ran across the stage, hit Takamiyama, and Takamiyama just went, Carson flew off his feet, went back about 8 feet, landed on his back, and went, "Okay, that wasn't planned." I mean, it was just really this incredible thing to realize how big this man is. So, in my research, I know that's a complete rabbit trail, has nothing to do with the text. But in my research on salt, there was a picture of a sumo wrestler entering the ring, which brought all of this back in my mind. Because one of the things they do is they throw salt into the ring before they enter. And when I was growing up, I always thought it was powder. So I had asked someone, and they said, "Oh no, they're throwing salt in the ring." And then they come into the ring, and there's this massive ritual that they do. You've seen it. They stomp their feet. They're not trying to intimidate the opponent. They're purifying the ring. The salt is to purify the ground. The stomping on the ground is to stomp away the evil spirits from the ring. And then when they're done, they clap their hands and do this to show they have no weapons. And you think, okay, what's the, you know, come on, you know, it's a kind of silly thing. Well, this is part of the Shinto Buddhist religion of the idea of evil spirits and wanting a pure contest. And if you ever look at any of the pictures of their matches, the referee is dressed in priestly robes. It's, you know, neck to ankle robe and a big hat, and he has a stick. And he looks like a priest. Well, technically, that's what he's doing. Of course, all he does is just get out of the way. Because, you know, there's certain things you can't do, but it's not like boxing where they come in and pull them apart or anything like that.
That's the origin of the handshake, is a way to check for weapons.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, you got nothing, we can talk.
Exactly. It's like showing that you are not a threat. So you look at all that and say, okay, that's history. Salt meant life or death. Wars are fought over it. We don't even think about it. It's like we don't think about our electricity or our water. We think about it when it's not there. Yeah, I mean, if it's not there, you're a little, and if your electricity goes off, the first thing you don't think is, I need to take my meat out of the freezer and salt it. No, you just hope you can get the power back on before it rots. Not realizing that you could actually preserve all the meat in your freezer by using the salt in your pantry, just like great grandma did. Very common. It's really not that far in the past that was the process that it was done.
Steve?
Yeah?
Did you do much research on the crocs, salt crocs?
The what?
The croc.
Salt
no.
Salt croc. Not a crocodile, a croc to keep stuff from purifying.
No, didn't see that at all.
You didn't see it.
No, in fact, I did ask the one question, and where do the little salt packets come from that you see at the fast food restaurants? I was just curious. I mean, who makes those? And why? And how much do they cost? So, you know, all these silly little trivia things that I go into. So I did a search for where do these come from. and found a machine that makes them. And guess, it was really kind of startling because the website I was taken to was Alibaba. The one, the company that was just did this big IPO and it's all over the news. You could spend $20,000 and have them ship this massive machine to your house. And it even shows how it'd be crated up and all that. I mean, it's got a ladder to the top of it, and it spits out the little packets all pre-made. And okay, whatever. But you can also buy 3,000 packets for $4.30. So if you need any salt, you know, at your dining room table, rather than that little, you know, doggy that you turn over and do this with, you can actually get your own salt packets for only $4.
Just remember, I need to buy some.
Yeah. Well, you look at all this and you go, okay, Steve, that was silly. And yes, it was. All right. And yet it's all an understanding of the importance of this particular, what do you call it, a condiment? This spice, whatever you want to call it. It's so common and yet it's not. Yet it's controlled, and yet Jesus says, we're the salt of the earth. Well, okay. So I started saying, well, where does the Bible overall look at the word salt? Goodness sake. I mean, the Bible is salted with the verses. The puns will keep coming, folks.
I don't know.
Yeah, I'm here all week. What?
I'm not sure everybody realizes this, but because, like you said, salt is common. But if we do not have salt in our diet, we die.
That's right.
Our muscles can't operate. The fluids in our body can't move. Yeah. Our nerves don't work properly.
It is life and death. Mm-hmm. Without salt, you die. It's just simple. You know, there are certain essentials that there are. Well, Job, he's answering, which guy? Trying to remember which one was talking to him. Eliphaz, his friend. Job comes back and says in Job chapter 6, can that which is tasteless be eaten without salt? Or is there any taste in the white of the egg? I mean, right out there in Job, he's using this as an example of what salt is, creates flavor. You've got in Leviticus chapter 2, let me find it here, because I can move a little quicker than you can, since I know where I'm headed. Luke 2:13, which is the whole chapter in the laws of the grain offering. It says, you shall season all your grain offerings with salt. You shall not let the salt of the covenant with your God be missing from your grain offering. With all your offerings you shall offer salt. Oh, so salt was part of the sacrifice. Yes, it was. In Numbers chapter 18, verse 19, it reads, all the holy contributions that the people of Israel present to the Lord, I give to you and to your sons and daughters with you as a perpetual due. It is a covenant of salt forever before the Lord for you and your offspring with you. A covenant of salt.
Don't the priests get yes. The food that comes in, and maybe that's taking care of two things at once.
Absolutely. If they are being presented raw meat that has been sacrificed, and if they're going to be able to eat it, they have to be able to preserve it. But where else are they going to get their salt unless the salt is included with the offerings? It's all part of it. And yet, at the same time, if salt is such an important commodity, it should be part of the sacrifice and not taken for granted.
I think much of our society is rotting spiritually, morally. I figured we want to stay on track on the right way. Well, church is the place where the preserver. Mm-hmm.
That's exactly right. 2 Chronicles 13:5 repeats what we saw in Numbers. Ought you not to know that the Lord God of Israel gave the kingship over Israel forever to David and his sons by a covenant of salt? We've passed over these verses in the past. We read them when we were studying these things before. I even have this phrase, covenant of salt, circled, because when we were teaching in Chronicles, we mentioned this, but not really dug into it per se. You get in Deuteronomy 29, Judges 9, and Zephaniah 2, all three places talk about destruction of the land. One was talking about Sodom and Gomorrah, and that the land was seeded with salt, so nothing would grow. Even Jesus, in another part of the Gospels, Mark chapter 9, people say he's alluding to his comments in the Sermon on the Mount here, because you don't find the Sermon on the Mount in Mark. But in Mark chapter 9, a couple paragraphs after the disciples are saying which one of us is greatest, Jesus says this, "For everyone will be salted with fire," or some verses say, "will be salted with fire, and every sacrifice will be salted with salt." Salt is good, but if the salt has lost its saltiness, how will you make it salty again? Have salt in yourselves and be at peace with one another. Fascinating. I mean, you look at all this, a common, average, everyday, easily found substance, and we're being called this. Now notice this. In the Beatitudes, every one of the characteristics of the believer is said in a third person manner. Blessed are those, or blessed are the merciful. It's saying, you know, blessed are those people, right? How does that change in verse 13?
You are.
You. It's no longer others or a theoretical, these kind of people. It's like he's turning to he's been talking to a group, and then he turns to you and says, "You are the salt of the earth." Very specifically, he declares us as salt. It is in the present tense, so it doesn't mean that you will become salt. It says you already are. As soon as you become a follower of Christ, Christ has declared you to be this item, this necessity, this key to life. It's an ongoing condition. You are the salt of the earth. It's a state of being. What I find interesting is that there are many, even within the church, that would prefer this to, Jesus would have said, "You are the sugar of the earth." Don't you think? Because we can just love people and we'd be sweet and nice and, you know, not offensive, and we just kind of make everybody feel better about themselves. He could have said that.
We wouldn't sting.
We wouldn't sting, we wouldn't preserve. There's all sorts of other things that we'll look at in a minute. But he could have said, "You are the sugar of the earth." Why didn't he say sugar? Sugar was a rare commodity. It was something special. It's something different.
Of course, sugar fits the scientific definition of purity, because you got to measure sugar. That's all there is. So technically, water is not pure because it's a compound, hydrogen, oxygen.
I'm not sure what you're saying.
Well, I figure if I got pure behavior, so I'm mixed. My church behavior is the same as my private behavior.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. So let's look at salt a little more, even in more detail. We've looked at the history of it. Now look at the salt itself. When God created our ability to smell, scientists have figured there's about 14,000 smells that we can pick out. 14,000. But with taste, there are only four. Only four. Can you name them? Ha, here's your biology test.
Science.
Sour, sweet.
Sour. Sweet.
Bitter.
And?
Salty.
Salty, exactly. Flavor comes from those four mixes. In fact, I found, you know, again, the trivia thing here. You take the tongue, here's the tongue. Right? Sweet is right here. Bitter is back here. Sour is on the two sides. And salt is here. That's how we know what things taste like. So, in fact, he said when you look at the taste buds, every tongue has between 2,000 and 5,000 taste buds. And each bud has between 50 and 100 receptors within it. You can burn them off by eating pepper. You know, peppers. I mean, some people actually lose their ability to taste things because they burned off through other things. Or let's say you drink too much hot liquid and you burn your tongue. Sometimes those things don't grow back. That can happen. But they've actually tested that if you put something sweet back here, you don't taste it. And you put something bitter here, you won't taste it until you swallow it and it passes over those. And then it's this reaction. Because you can actually go like that and go, that's nothing. Oh. Because you have now put it, your tongue back in and swallowed, and now suddenly you taste it. Isn't that fascinating? Amazing how God did that. So we have all this variety with smell, but we have all this uniqueness with taste. And then on top of that, I mentioned it before, salt is easily found. Goodness sake, the Dead Sea within a day's walk. You know, goodness, you can find all the salt you want on the beach. Now, it's the kind of salt, by the way, in the Dead Sea is not, again, you're not going to find it in your salt shaker. It's a different kind because there's other stuff mixed in with it. They talk about the power of salt. 0.04 ounces of salt dissolved in 140 gallons of water can be tasted. I mean, that's just a smidge. And 140 gallons is now tainted or turned into a salty concoction.
I heard the Dead Sea has so much salt in it, you don't have to worry about drowning.
That's correct. I've been there. I watched the people climb, walk in with their swimsuits and lay back, and they just float on the top. And they try to go under, and you can't because the salt just bobs you on the top of the water.
Of course, I heard there are people who are like the Dead Sea. They receive all but give back nothing. I avoid such people.
You can do the same thing in the salt and sea.
Really?
The salt and sea, you can walk in. It's the funniest thing. And salt, Great Salt Lake, you know, the Montevideo salt flats. But the salt and sea in California, there's Southern California, was
very similar to that. It's interesting. By the way, if you ever go on a cruise ship and you don't take a little dip in the pool, it's not. It's salt water. It's a real shock if you didn't know that. I mean, they're not going to use regular water and chlorinate it when they're out in the ocean. That would be a waste. They could just pump the water out of the ocean and stick it in the swimming pool. I'll never forget because I was on my very first, you know, cruise, thought, oh, I'll take a dip in the pool, be so nice and refreshing. Woohoo! Oh my gosh, you know, salt in the eyes and the nose and the mouth. It was just quite exciting. Not what I expected.
Probably won't take a cruise anytime soon. Those things tend to break.
Now, what is salt made of? You know the chemical compounds are what?
Sodium chloride.
Sodium is a silvery white metal with the consistency of hard cheese. And if you take sodium and drop it in water, it creates hydrogen gas and explodes. Don't do that. Not a good thing.
If you eat one or the other, it will kill you.
Chlorine, which is chloride, is a gas. And we all know that if you have too much chlorine in your pool, it has an odor that's a little overwhelming. If this room was full of chlorine gas, we would all die. Because it's a poison. So when you put sodium and chlorine or chloride together, it creates salt. So two poisons, two dangerous compounds mixed together, creates something that is the elixir of life. Isn't that interesting? And then Jesus says to us, you are the ticking time bomb of the earth. No, because sodium chloride is not dangerous at all. It's not going to explode. You can't do anything to make it explode. You can bang on it with a hammer and just, turns into powder. Salt is also technically a rock. It's the only rock we eat. And its chemical shape is a perfect cube. Think of a dice or a sugar cube. So even if you take salt, grind it into a powder, just grind, so it's just a fine powder. Take that fine powder and put it under the microscope, and it's still a cube. No matter what you do to it, it's a perfectly shaped cube. And as one person went, hey, that means as a Christian, it's cool to be square. I thought that was pretty clever.
How about the new heaven?
Yeah, there you go. So, we take salt as a chemical compound, as something very common. And I know how your mind's working. In fact, a few of you already brought up a few things. The metaphor from the spiritual side is incredibly rich. I don't even need to point the signs to you. But as we discuss this, you start thinking, Jesus, in his infinite wisdom, was saying something to everyone who heard this, that the more you think about it, the deeper the meaning gets. To use salt in olden days or whatever, how do you apply the salt? Do you simply take the pile of salt and move it closer and say, okay, it'll be in the same room with the meat and it'll just be, the meat will be fine? No. What does it take? Direct application. It has to be applied. You have to take the salt and put it on the item to preserve it, to save it, to do whatever to it, to flavor it. If you need to put salt on your food and there's a salt shaker on the table, you don't just look at the salt shaker and go, oh, I think it'll make its way over here. No, you have to pick it up and do this. And if it doesn't come out right, you'll look at the top and go, well, look at that. The holes are clogged up. And so you open up the hole so there's more opportunity to have saltiness. Has this ever happened to you where you've been in a restaurant and the previous person who sat at the table decided to play a trick and unscrew the top of the salt shaker? It has happened to me. I was with a client in Texas. Nice steak restaurant. One of these really fine places. And we're having this great conversation and steak comes, and of course it's going to need a little bit of salt. And I do, boom, and the whole top comes off. And the contents, big pile on top of the steak. I just looked at it, and I looked at this client, this first time we had met. And he went, oh my. I went, I'm not very happy right now. And because I'm with you, I can't lose my temper. And he laughed, he called over the guy, and they came with, they were, of course, very apologetic. They obviously cooked another steak, but it caused enormous delay for our meal because he had already been served. you think, so frustrating, but there's an example where too much salt is not a good thing. And other things, I mean, I love popcorn. I'll tell you, popcorn without salt is a waste of time. I mean, it's like eating a rice cake. You know, what's the point? Why do we even bother with this? All right. In certain mining processes of salt, it can be brought out in large chunks. And that has to be broken down. So salt if it's clumped up, has to be broken from like a fragile rock and be ground into that powdery feel.
So many cubes.
Mm-hmm. Well, and in fact, the salt that you have in your salt shaker has a component in it to keep it from clumping while it sits there. So in a humid environment, your salt still moves around inside. It's because there's something added to it. They also add iodine into it for some other, you know, for other reasons. So it's not actually super, super pure. I asked the question, what's the difference between sea salt and table salt? Well, sea salt is actually from the sea, and they dry it. And it has different flavor, different components, and sometimes it comes in, you know, chunky pieces that you get at the store, and they say it's more healthy. Every health site I visited went, that is a complete misnomer. It just tastes different, that's all.
Well, when I think of the word organic, that I think costs more, spoils sooner.
Yeah. Now, you had mentioned about the need for salt in the body. And, you know, what was it? There's people who are vegan, end up having salt deficiency because they don't eat enough salt in their body. Because their vegetables don't necessarily provide enough unless they put salt on it. But they have to think about it because there's not as much as normally you would find, for example, in certain meats and other food byproducts. They say that, and I remember this when the last couple years of my dad's life, there was this very big concern for him in monitoring the amount of salt in his intake, because if he had too much salt, then his body would produce more liquid, and the liquid would then cause stress on his blood pressure and his congestive heart failure and all of those kinds of things. So there was this constant battle of having just enough salt to maintain his certain weight, but then if he ballooned up a little bit, they'd say, well, we got too much salt in his body. And it was this constant battle with his salt, and he was frustrated because he liked the taste. You know, I mean, I remember going through their kitchen with my mom, because she can't see. And so she would have me read the ingredients and everything in the cupboards and all the snack foods and everything else. And she would go, well, Roger really likes those. How much is that? Well, he can have one of those a day. And then she would put it aside and put a little note or something on that box. And then we put it back in the cupboard. But there was this intent to try to monitor it, because more salt creates liquid to build up. Less salt creates dehydration, cramps, and death.
And see, salt, some people don't have enough salt because they can't cool off. And that is one of the things in the health area down at the Community Police Center in Atlanta. They always check for anybody that's there for that process and make sure
they're getting enough salt.
Interesting. It needs the cooling process.
Well, they say that Napoleon's army, in their retreat from Moscow, not only was it cold, not only did they have all the other things, but they didn't have enough salt. And so the soldiers began to die because they didn't have the salt in their diet. They started cramping up. All the terrible things that would happen to them, and they were all, it was one of the challenges in their retreat, is they just didn't have the right kind of supplies to keep it going. Now, I remember back in college, Lisa and I were dating at the time, and I was working construction in South Tempe. I still know which apartment complex I helped build, and I will never live there. I saw it built. Oh my, the shortcuts some of those guys took. Anyway, but we would have to get up, I mean, be at work at 5 in the morning, and work ended at 1. So we had our 8-hour shift had to be done before the heat of the day because it was summer. And, you know, I'm, 19, 20 years old. I'm not even really thinking about it. And, you know, you're out there in the heat and you're working. And, I mean, at one point I was stapling the 4x8 panels on the roof. So you have the, you know, the trestles, and then you put the 4x8 panels on top of which all the other roofing stuff goes. And we were supposed to staple every 6 inches, alternating. And we figured it was 140 degrees up on that roof. And so up there doing, okay, I'm fine. And it was 2 weeks later when the city inspector came, my boss called me up to that roof and he went, "Were you drunk when you stapled this?" And I looked at it and there was a staple here, a staple over here, a staple up here. And I figured what had happened is that I was so hot and so overheated, I started to stagger. And wasn't even really thinking, I just wanted to get it done, just to get out of there and get a drink of water. And so I had to then go and restaple the entire roof of the apartment complex to make it safe.
Has it stayed up?
Oh yeah, it's still there. Yeah. But when I would have, I still remember, I don't know if you remember this, but I was eating at Lisa's parents' house. We were eating dinner, and whatever meal was being served, and served the food, and I began salting my food. And I'm just having a conversation, and I remember her mom looking, going, it doesn't really need that much salt. And I looked down, and I realized what I was doing. My body was craving it so much because I'd been sweating out the salt at such high rates, I was not replacing it. And we began talking about that, and someone actually recommended buying salt tablets. And a lot of the fellows who work in high heat, high construction, they actually take salt tablets to replace the salt that they're losing, because you can drink the water, that's fine, you're replenishing, but you're also losing the salt, and it can create very difficult health problems. So anyway, so we have all that. You know, it says here salt has to come in close contact. I mean, when they preserved the meat, you rubbed it in. Actually, you know, you would butcher the animal or, you know, fillet the fish or whatever, and then you either rub it in with the hand or you put it in a, I would understand in the fishing industry, you'd put it in a salt brine, like a salt water to preserve, is that what they would do?
Yeah, and also we take salt pills on the fishing boat.
Okay, really? Okay.
Yeah, almost a commercial fish, salmon fish, and even though it was, the water temperature was 28, air temperature 48, we still needed salt tablets.
Interesting. But in preserving the fish itself?
You have that way, you know, they have brine tanks.
Okay.
For your crustaceans also, shrimp and...
And that's because you're out for more than one day. You're not actually bringing your catch back the same day. So whatever you catch that day, you have to preserve it before you bring it back. You see, this is still very common.
And you keep them, and in some places, you keep them alive.
Oh.
And you take from Kodiak, Alaska, down to Seattle for you.
That's how the live lobsters are in the tank.
Wonderful.
Or the crabs are in the tank, yeah. Okay. Well, Vance Havner had this nice little comment to say. Salt must be brought into close contact with whatever is meant to be to affect if it is to do any good. Christians are the salt of the earth. We must be willing to be rubbed into the decaying carcass of an unregenerate society. Most of us are content to sit on Sunday in our little salt shakers, far removed from a needy and lost humanity. Sort of like a box of garden seeds looks very attractive with its pretty colored package, but the seeds must be emptied into the dirty earth to die, to come up again if we are to have anything to eat. Christians look pretty enough in church on Sunday morning, but except a corn of wheat fall on the ground and die, it abideth alone. Isn't that interesting? So what are some of the things that salt does? Well, number one, it seasons. Right? We've talked about that. It flavors. There's all sorts of different seasonings. Salt is the most common. I found it interesting in reading a business journal once about JCPenney when he interviewed prospective management applicants. He would take them to a very nice meal. And if they salted their food before they ate it, he would not hire them. Because he would say, how do they know it needs it? They're making a decision without investigating it first. I read that and went, man, if that ever got out, you would have all sorts of guys going, I ain't touching that salt shaker till after that thing, take my first bite. You know, but you assume. Well, that's the problem in a lot of management. You assume something. You don't figure it out first and then make the decision. You make assumptions. But it's a seasoning. In the Scottish, there's a Scottish translation, and it talks about you are the salt of the earth, but if salt loses its tang, not its taste, but they use the word tang. And I suppose there's a meaning to that, that a seasoning brings zest, or it brings a burst that you go, oh, now that was good. It also stimulates thirst. And you think about that one from the metaphor of the Christian life. If you are there in a situation and you create and you ask the right questions, maybe you can stimulate other questions because you're stimulating thirst. That is what salt is. But if you empty your salt shaker into the water, no one will drink it. This isn't going to be a fair comparison, but it's the only one that I can think of from my own experience. Back to that construction site in South Tempe. All right, the guys on the crew, they knew I was a Bible major and that I was going to earn enough money so I could, you know, help with college and whatnot the next year. And they gave me a little bit of hard time for, you know, being the Christian and being the Bible boy and, you know, that kind of stuff. Fine. You know, they were all trying to sell me drugs and other things like that. It was just a wonderful experience. But another young man came onto the crew later in the summer, and he was an on-fire evangelist. Trained in Campus Crusade. 4 spiritual law tracts in his work pack. In his hip pack. And I mean, he was aggressive in his presentation. And you know, good for him. But in that context, he was too much salt. Because they hated him. They went to the manager and asked to be not assigned to him for the day. Then they would come to me and complain about that Christian fanatic. My problem was, as a young kid, I wasn't salty enough. And that's where I have regrets. I had opportunities. Yeah, I had conversations with some of these guys, but I don't think I did a good job. But this other fellow was pouring the whole salt shaker at him. And they just, I don't want that. They weren't thirsty. They were rejecting it completely. Because they were so taken aback. So there's that idea of balance, and that's a whole other class on how to present the gospel.
People may agree with the message, but they're turned on by the delivery.
Exactly. Uh-huh. Exactly. Another thing that salt does is it heals. You gargle with salt water with a sore throat to help relieve and cleanse some of the particles that are in there. You bathe in Epsom salts to soothe angry muscles and certain things. Someone is needing to wake up, and and you give them what?
Smelling salts.
Now, granted, that's an ammonia tablet, but it's the idea. but it pops you awake. It's that idea of bringing life back into something. And at the same time, I think one of you mentioned about that salt, however, can be an irritant. If you have an open wound, oh, that hurts. If you get salt in that open wound, try scraping your knee and then go swimming in the ocean. You suddenly remember that you had a scrape on your knee very quickly because it's really painful. But while it's being irritated, it's being purified. In 2 Kings chapter 2, Elisha goes into this town and they complain that the water is bad. And he says, somebody bring me a bowl of salt. I went, okay. He brings a bowl of salt, he walks to the river and dumps it in the river, and the river is purified. Now, he didn't go to each bowl of water or each large jar and put some salt in each one. No, he went to the source, purified the source, and it was a miracle. And the people suddenly went, wow, your God is really powerful. The last thing it does, and we talked about this already, it's a preservative. I mean, before refrigeration, it was the only way to keep things from rotting. And as you mentioned, our society is rotting. And if we separate ourselves from our society completely and 100%, it will continue to rot. And that's, I think, one of the applications that Jesus is saying is to go out and be that salt in the world to prevent or at least somehow stem the tide of decay. Well, last thing.
You haven't mentioned the blocks of salt that's put out for animals.
Oh, yeah. Well, of course. The salt licks. Yeah. Well, wasn't Lot's wife a salt lick? In fact, when I visited the Holy Land and we were in the Sodom area, they actually drove by a pillar of salt in the middle of the desert, and they say, well, that's Lot's wife. And I'm thinking, after 3,000 years, man, that must have been one heck of a salt lick. But at least it's the idea that right in the middle of the desert, seemingly, where did it come from? Because everything around it is dirt. And right in the middle of it, and the donkeys will, well, they'll take a lick and they'll move on. It's part of their journey.
Of course, that's what happens when we look back, arrested development.
Mm-hmm. Well, the other half of this verse, but if salt loses its taste, how shall its saltiness be restored? There has been so much ink spilled on this concept because technically salt cannot lose its flavor. Scientifically, pure salt is one of the most stable chemical compounds known to man. One fellow actually talked about finding a sea ration from World War II and pulling it out, and in it were salt packets. And he opened the salt packet, this is 1973, 30 years later, and he goes, salt's still good. Hasn't lost its saltiness. So what is he talking about here? How can salt lose its flavor? He's not necessarily talking about pure salt, if you want to get really technical, because the salt that was around this area, much of it would have been from salt, from sea salt, from the coastal areas where they pull it off the ocean or from down in the sea. And because it wasn't pure, it actually could lose its tanginess over time if it ended up interacting with other things. For example, if they stored it in a pile on the ground, the bottom layer that touched the ground would leach the saltiness out of it, and all that's left is just more dirt. It was salt, but it's dirt. And they actually said, just throw it out, put it into the cracks in the road, make it part of the road repair. And that's the idea of if it's, it needs to be thrown out and trampled under people's feet because it's absolutely of no good or no use to anybody if it loses its power. However, I think this is an an interesting concept that we can look at now because of our scientific understanding of this. And maybe I'm adding to the text that isn't there. And I think you mentioned it earlier. But pure salt is going to maintain its power. And isn't earlier in the Beatitudes, blessed are the pure in heart? And if our salt becomes, we add things to it, we take away its purity, we become less effective, that we let our salt become impure, it has the potential of losing its power. Now, you know, that can be overstated, and I don't mean to. But Charles Spurgeon addressed this. He said here, a professing Christian with no grace in him, a religious man whose very religion is dead, what good is he? And he is himself in a hopeless condition. You can salt meat, but you cannot salt salt. There are people who believe that you can be children of God today and then children of the devil tomorrow, then children of God the next day and children of the devil again the day after. But believe me, that is not so. If the work of grace is really wrought of God in your soul, it will last through your whole life. And if it does not last, that proves that it was not the work of God in the first place. God will not put his hand to his work a second time. There's no regeneration twice over. You can't be born again and again and again and again and again, as some teach. There is no note in Scripture of that kind. Hence, I rejoice that regeneration, once truly wrought in the Spirit of God, is an incorruptible seed which liveth and abideth forever. But beware, professor, which I thought was interesting, beware, professor, lest you should be like salt that has lost its savor and are therefore good for nothing. At the same time, another story came from Phil Newton, talks about a missionary in Kenya where a couple had served for 15 years and never saw any outward response. They labored faithfully, served the people, taught the gospel, did all they could to set Christ before the people, but no one responded. 15 years. Until a couple days after they left, the missionary family's maid, the two gardeners, and the milkman converged upon the empty house and related how they missed those people. And they wept, a sense of loss, and reflected on what they saw in them and what they had been taught by them. And one by one they called upon the Lord, coming to faith in Christ, and the church began to build in that community. Because, as he's putting it, those missionaries had been salt in those people's lives. They may not have ever seen the reaction, but they did see. Ultimately, God's purposes were wrought. And then lastly, another good quote that I found. The news magazines reported a few years ago that Americans tend to see themselves as potential saints rather than real sinners. The same magazine later said, "Today's young radicals in particular are almost painfully sensitive to the wrongs in their society, and they denounce them violently. At the same time, they are typically American in that they fail to place evil in its historic and human perspective. To them, evil is not an irreducible component of man, nor is it an inescapable fact of life, but evil is something committed by older generations, committed and attributable to a particular class, and a particular establishment, and it can be eradicated through love and revolution." The magazine was Time Magazine. The year was 1969. Isn't that sound like it was written last week? Things never change. Man's sinfulness never changes?
Of course, unfortunately, too many people, their role model is Homer Simpson. I do as I say, not as I do.
Yep. Too little salt, no impact. Too much salt, no impact. It's a balance. But we are the salt of the earth. Jesus has challenged us where we are placed. We have been shaken out from the salt shaker of God's hand into the communities and the homes, the families, the situations we are each in. And in that context, we must be that place, that person who can heal, who can help preserve, who can help purify, who can help make a difference. We can be an irritant. We can make a change. And that, I believe, is the challenge and the message of this simple little passage and this lovely history of salt that you enjoyed this morning. I hope you enjoyed it. Let's pray. Lord, thank you for our time together. Again, so much here. So much to study, a lifetime of study. Goodness. A fascination, and yet such powerful words that we, each one of us, the moment we have agreed to become one with you, you then empower us to be that salt, that difference maker in the world into which we have been placed. Lord, thank you for our time together. In Jesus' name, amen.